Hello, this is Sherry Moran, pursuit of House Rule 10-10.01. I call the remote hearing of the Health and Human Service Policy Committee to order. Well, member, of course, the first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes from Wednesday, April 29th. The minutes were included in your package, so you all should have them. Are there any questions in regards to the minutes? Okay, so we will, if you can unmute yourself, we will, I will have Representative Morrison move the minutes. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? So the motion prevails and the minutes are approved. So today, members, today we have a hearing of our second policy bill. So we have our second hearing on our policy bill. Once amended, House File 3727 will align with a bill that we passed last week, that was passed last week by Senator Benson. And please, if you do not hear me, please let me know, okay? It was passed last week by Senator Benson committee that matches her policy jurisdiction. This includes legislation regarding the Department of Health, healthcare providers, and public health plans. I have worked with Senator Benson to make these bills as close to identical as possible before they reach their respective floors to help avoid the need for a conference.
Chair Moran, I don't think we can hear you.
You cannot hear me, huh? Okay. Let's see what I can do here. Give me a moment. Okay, is this better? Chris?
Is it better? We can hear you, Madam Chair.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you. Good. So we will review the bills, and I would try to speak up, too, and speak a little bit louder if possible. But we will review the bill similar to our process in House File 3322, starting with presentations on any provisions that were not previously heard by the committee, and then moving on to the amendments. Many of the new provisions are bills that would have been scheduled for a hearing before the committee deadlines, if not for the COVID-19 pandemic. We are authorized to meet past 4 p.m. today if we need to finish the work at hand. So I'm going to make two motions now to put the bill in the delete all amendment before the committee, and then we will begin. So the chair first moves that House File 3727 be recommended for placement on the general register. I would next move adoption of the DE2 amendment. Now that the amendment is before the committee, I would like to ask House Research to provide a brief walkthrough of the full bill. And then we will invite bill authors to provide a more thorough explanation of any provisions that are new to the committee. So I think we're going to start with Article 1 with Ms. Carcris. Article 2 would be presented by Mrs. Ms. Sunderman. And the third article would be walk through by Mr. Chu, and then Article 4 again will be presented by Ms. Carcris. No, the people know I'm in committee right now. I'm getting all these calls from members. So hopefully, as you are going through the article, I would try to do a check through to see if someone who should be on this hearing is on this hearing. So I'm going to stop there and allow Mrs. Clarquist to run through Article 1.
So, Madam Chair and members, I'll start with Article 1. This is the Health Department article. Sections 1 through 9 and 15 come from House File 3791, the first engrossment. This is authored by Representative Hewitt. And these sections make changes to the regulation of X-ray equipment and sources of ionizing radiation and individuals authorized to operate X-ray systems. Changes include updating language, making technical and clarifying changes, reorganizing provisions, and specifying qualifications for people who are authorized to operate X-ray systems. The difference between the bill in its first engrossment form and the sections that are included in this article is found in Section 5 on lines 4.1 to 4.4. And these clauses were amended in this article to correct some errors that were in the first engrossment.
Okay, we will move on to Article 2. Ms. Sutherman?
Madam Chair, actually, there are a few more sections in Article 1.
Okay, please proceed.
Sorry. Sections 10 and 11 of this article are from House File 3582, authored by Representative Lislegard. And the version of the text that's in this article is from Senate File 3488, the first engrossment. And these sections specify that patients must be provided with health information or health records within 30 calendar days of the patient making the request to the provider. Section 12 of this article is from Senate File 3895. And this section permits rather than requires a medical cannabis manufacturer to operate 8 distribution facilities in the state and requires the Commissioner of Health to conduct at least one unannounced inspection of the manufacturing facilities and distribution facilities for each manufacturer until there's implementation of a seed-to-sale system. Section 13 is from House File 3199, the first engrossment, a Representative Freiberg bill. And this section allows patients who receive veterans disability or railroad disability payments to pay the reduced fee of $50 to enroll in the medical cannabis program. And Section 14 is new language. Section 144.591 was enacted in 2019 and requires hospitals to provide an itemized description of billed charges to patients within 30 calendar days of discharge. It was supposed to become effective on August 1st of 2020, and this section pushes out that effective date to January 1st, 2021. And that concludes Article 1.
But thank you for that. And so we'll move on to Article 2 and Ms. Sutherman. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, Article 2 covers changes related to health-related licensing boards. Section 1 just modifies a cross-reference related to changes later in the article in the physician assistant chapter. Section 2 requires health plans to cover drugs prescribed and dispensed by a pharmacist under the same terms of coverage that would otherwise apply, and that's specifically self-administered hormonal contraceptives, nicotine replacement medications, and opiate antagonists for the treatment of an acute opiate overdose. And though that change is also related to some changes later in the article. Sections 3 to 18, 26, and 30 are all sections related to physician assistant licensure and practice. These are generally just updates to Chapter 147A. A couple of more significant changes are that physician delegation agreements are now done away with, and physician assistants and physicians must enter into collaborative agreements to practice, which are broader and are only for a certain amount of time. And then there is a practice level practice agreement delineating the services that the physician assistant would provide. It also modifies some of the patient services that are permitted and outlines physician assistant prescribing authority, which I believe used to be part of delegation agreements for physician assistants. And there are various updates throughout to cross-references, deleting obsolete dates, that sort of thing, updating terminology. Going to section 19, which was, let me just pull up the bill list here. Sections, section 2 and then sections 19 and 20, 22 to 24 and 27 and 28 are the sections that allow pharmacists to prescribe self-administered hormonal contraceptives, nicotine replacement medications, and opiate antagonists for treatment of an acute opiate overdose pursuant to various requirements that are added to the statutes. And they list the requirements for prescribing, the circumstances under which a pharmacist can prescribe, that sort of thing. And section 21, which was Representative Schumacher's bill, House File 2150, allows for telemedicine evaluations to suffice for prescribing drugs to treat erectile dysfunction. Moving down to section 25, that is new language. It was not part of a bill. It amends section 151.555, subdivision 3, and it makes changes to the Board of Pharmacy RFP process for the drug repository central repository. It makes it optional for there to be an RFP, and it also allows the board to work directly with the University of Minnesota to create a central repository. Going to section 29, this is also new language, was not part of a bill. This would allow prescribing practitioners to use telemedicine examinations in order to prescribe drugs that are used for substance use disorder treatment. And this is during the COVID-19 peacetime emergency. And section 30 is the repealer relating to the changes to the physician assistant licensure chapter. And that concludes Article 2.
All right, thank you, Ms. Sutherman. Okay, we're going to move on to Article 3 and Mr. Chan.
Okay. Madam Chair, Article 3 is the healthcare article. Sections 1, 4 to 8, 10 to 12, and 32 to 36 are all from Representative Olson's House File 3838. This was the opioid, I guess, fix bill. This article includes the provisions from that bill that were not passed as chapter 71. So the provisions in this article would convert the opiate account into a fund. It would change terminology from medical gas distributor to medical gas dispenser. It modifies the opiate council procedures, allowing the Minnesota Hospital Association to appoint the representative to the council and changing the term length from 4 years to 3 years, and it also modifies fees. The next group of sections, quite a few of them, are from the base bill, House File 3727, which is the DHS policy bill that you're carrying. So these would be sections 2-3, 9, 13 to 19, 21 to 24, 26 to 27, 29 to 31, and 37 to 38. So these sections clarify that the health department has the responsibility for certifying healthcare homes. It also codifies certain federal requirements, and it updates laws related to MA and Minnesota Care Administration to reflect current practice. And I'll just mention a few of these sections. Section 9 updates the provision related to the DHS state medical review team, so it reflects current practice. Sections 13 to 19 and 21 update and clarify provisions related to ME eligibility to reflect current DHS practice and to also incorporate federal requirements. Some of these changes include updating the MA income limit to reflect the modified adjusted gross income methodology, also codifying some federal requirements related to asset verification and Veterans Administration pensions. Then section 22, this clarifies that the cost of a private room in an assisted living facility is not considered a medical expense that can be deducted from income. Sections 23 to 24 would limit MA payment for inpatient services to hospitals that are Medicare certified, and they also clarify coverage for organ transplant services. So these sections align the statute with the current payment methodology being used by DHS. Section 29 corrects the starting date for the cost-based payment system used for critical access hospitals. Sections 30 and 31 deal with Minnesota Care. They clarify that behavioral health home services are not a covered Minnesota Care service. They also delete some obsolete language related to premiums. And finally, section 30 is a repealer that repeals mainly obsolete sections. And that would conclude Article 3.
All right, thank you so much. So members, are there any questions on provision in the DE1 amendments that we have just heard? Okay.
Madam Chair, I'll just note Article 4. We'll have House Research walk through that real quickly as well.
Article 4, okay. House Research, can you... Please proceed.
Madam Chair and members, Article 4 is the Advanced Practice Registered Nurses article. This language is from House File 1914, the First Division Engrossment, a Representative Edelson bill. This article adds the term Advanced Practice Registered Nurse to several statutes to give APRNs the rights, duties, protections, and authority in those sections. Also, sections 115 and 140 of this article were added to House File 1914 in the Finance Committee, and they were from House File 3545, a Representative Freiberg bill. Section 115 adds APRNs and podiatrists to the practitioners who can prescribe prosthetic and orthotic devices. And Section 140 repeals a rule related to providers authorized to prescribe these devices in order to be eligible for MA coverage. And the difference between this article and House File 1914 is found in Section 103, which is on page 152 of the DE amendment. And the phrase patient and registered nurse was added on line 152.17. And registered nurse was added on line 152.19. And that concludes Article 4. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I also realized, I'm sorry, I forgot three independent sections in Article 3 that I'll go over that are three separate bills.
Please.
So Section 20 of Article 3, this is House File 3322, Representative Kunesh-Podein. This deals with treatment for breast or cervical cancer. It allows MA coverage for persons screened by programs other than the SAGE program. Section 25 of Article 3, this is from House File 3026, the first engrossment of Reps of Man. This deals with MA coverage of clinical trials. It clarifies that the MA program may cover services that are not related to the clinical trial. And Section 28, this is from House File 3313, Representative Noor. This requires health carrier reimbursement for dental services that are provided under a treatment plan, even if the plan is not completed. So my apologies for forgetting those sections.
That's okay. Thank you. Okay, so we have my COA, Jasmine, on the line, who will kind of like give me a flag if there's any questions. And I don't see any right now, but I just want to open up and say if there's any questions on provision in the DE1 amendment, please ask your question now. Okay, seeing none. What I would like to do is take us back to the top of the presentation and allow us to hear from each of the authors of the provisions in Article 1. We will begin with non-committed members so they can leave the call afterward if they wish. And we will pause for questions after each presentation. From Article 1, Section 10 and 11 on House File 3582, we have Representative Ms. Lagarde. This provision modifies the timelines for providing health record copies to patients. Representative Listergar, we have you up next for about a few minutes.
This provision basically, I was talking to myself. Hi, Ms. Madam Chair, members. This provision, I don't think it'll take 2 minutes. It just basically does a little clarification or because the current law says that any healthcare provider does not have to release, or they release underneath the word prompt. And I think that what this does, it originally was 15 days. We settled with the Senate at 30. And I believe that that this will help care providers and individuals do their planning. So it's basically just to take out the prompt and put in 30 days that they will be required to release the information. And I have Mr. Lehman here to answer any questions people may have.
Thank you, Representative. Members, do you have any questions? Okay, seeing no questions, we will move on. Thank you, Representative Listergaard. We'll move on to Article 1, Section 14. This is a new provision in the bill. It delays implementation of hospital building transparency requirements. And I would move forward with Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be able to be before your committee again today. The only change that is made pursuant to the DE amendment that was just adopted at the outset of this committee is moving the implementation of the effective date of the hospital billing transparency requirements out about 4 months to January of next year. So this has broad support among both Democrats, Republicans in the Senate and in the House, and this was something that we are changing to orient ourselves in real time around some of the logistical challenges that a lot of hospitals are experiencing as a result of the COVID-19 crisis. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to take questions.
All right. Thank you, Representative Cantrell. Members, are there any questions? All right. I don't see any raised hands. Thank you. And we're going to move on to Article 2. Section 25, this is also new language by Representative Limpert. It allows the Board of Pharmacy to waive an RFP process for establishing a central drug repository. Representative Limpert?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So last year we established the ability for a drug repository to open. This allows unused medications to be sent to a repository to be redistributed rather than thrown away. And the Drug Repository Group is moving forward with the help of the University of Minnesota and the Board of Pharmacy, and they want to open up as soon as possible to help with COVID-19. University of Minnesota would like to take a lead role in getting the repository up and running. However, the current law requires the board to issue an RFP, and due to COVID-19, the Department of Administration is focused on procuring supplies needed for COVID-19 and will be slow in processing any RFP. And also, the Drug Repository Board received only one RFP last year, and it didn't meet the minimum requirements and wasn't accepted. So this amendment will remove the RFP requirement. And since there was only one RFP submitted last year, it won't freeze out anyone, and it'll allow the drug repository to get up and running. The amendment was suggested by Cody Weiberg of the Board of, Pharmacy.
All right, thank you, Representative Linford. Members, do you have any questions? Okay. We're seeing none. Thank you, Mr. Representative Linford. Appreciate the bill. We are going to move on to our Article 2, Section 29. This is also new language by Representative Baker, which allows the SUV treatment prescription via telemedicine during COVID-19 peacetime emergency. Representative Baker.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for your time today. I just wanted to highlight our friends from the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation are doing a lot of outpatient services now, obviously not in person, but with telemedicine. We're trying to just align our language so that it matches up better with the federal statutes. And the Board of Pharmacy has been great to work with and have put out some conversations about making sure that their enforcements would be modified a bit, but we just want to get it codified in language here so that the providers are actually doing it the way the law is written. So this is a temporary version. This will also expire after 60 days of when the emergency order will end. And right now, things are working quite well with folks in outpatient treatment, with our friends at Betty Ford, as well as other providers. So I would appreciate this language being part of your bill. Stand for questions. And also, I want to say that former Commissioner Emily Piper is on the phone to answer any questions as well from Betty Ford.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Do we have any questions for Representative Baker? All right, so thank you, Representative Baker. We're going to move on to Article 3, Section 28, which is Representative Noah, House File 3313, requires partial reimbursement by Medicare County treatment plans that are not fully completed. Representative Noah.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Currently, dentists who provide care to medical assistant patients must complete all steps of multi-state procedures to be paid for the care they provided. As you know, medical assistant patients are more transient population, and in many cases, they move, lose coverage, or change coverage during a multi-step dental procedure. Currently, dentists do not get paid unless they complete all the steps, resulting in significant loss for dentists every year due to no fault of their own. Minnesota has one of the lowest reimbursement rates in the country and one of the smallest ranges of coverage in dental care. This amendment or bill simply makes it so dentists get paid for the services they've already provided when the patient fails to show up, loses coverage, or changes coverage during a multi-step dental procedure. This bill will give providers assurance if they take in a patient who is going to do a multi-step procedure, they'll get paid for the care they've already provided, even if the patient fails to show up. Loss of coverage or changes coverage during a multi-step dental procedure. We believe that if the dentists know that they'll be paid for procedures, multi-step procedures, they will be taking the risk of providing care to medical assistant patients. So that's simply what the bill will do. I have Deborah Hellstrom, if you have any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Noor. Members, do we have any questions? All right. Seeing no questions, we will move on to Article 3, which is various section of the bill. Let's see, that would be me. Find my notes here.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
So this is the DHS Healthcare Administration policy bill that Mr. Chun walked through briefly, and Matt Burdick from the department will explain any more detail for you.
Oh, awesome. Okay. So, yes, it is a DFL bill. So do we have Matt Burdick on the line? Mr. Burdick, can you walk Article 3 in the various section walk us through those sections?
Certainly, Madam Chair. For the record, Matt Burdick with the Department of Human Services. I will take this kind of bucketed by proposals since Mr. Chun ran through some of this already. And then if folks have questions, happy. I've got a few friends on the line as well that can help out. So the first big kind of section of things that we're working on are sections 2 and 3, 26 and 27, and 37 and 38. This is simply moving sections of law that deal with healthcare homes out of Medicaid statute and into the statutes governed by the Department of Health is the entity responsible for kind of for doing the certifications and for managing this program. And so this is just a reorganization of the statutes to reflect that. Section 9, which I believe Mr. Chun touched on, relates to our state's medical review team. This is a team that helps people receive determinations of a disability that would qualify them for medical assistance. And this is updating the statute to reflect some process improvement we've done with between the relationship between the state and the county and how those services are handled. So right now, the county makes a referral to the state. The state then works with the person's various medical providers. And then once that determination that the person does have a disability, the county then receives that information back to process the eligibility. And the current statute creates some confusion that it's the county's role rather than the state's to go and work with the individual medical providers. And so we're trying to clarify that. Sections 13 through 16, 19 and 20, 30 and 31, and portions of 38, which is the repealer. These are the sections that are updating our statute to reflect either things that have been developed via policy that we want to make sure are codified in state law so that they're clear for all involved and that we are kind of making sure that we have all of the authorities we need in place, as well as making corrections based on changes at the federal level to make sure that we are aligning with changes that have happened then since we've last updated our state statutes around the medical assistance and Minnesota care programs. Section 18 updates our codifies our policy around something the legislature passed in 2017, which is known as the asset verification system. This was a federal mandate that requires people that have an asset test in order to qualify for medical assistance to allow for a review of financial systems records in order to ensure that there are not uncounted assets out there. And this is codifying the policy that goes around that process that was enacted by the legislature several years ago. Section 21 simply aligns state law with federal policy that allows for a veteran who's in a long-term care facility to retain the hire of either what's known as a personal needs allowance, which is exactly what it sounds like, or their VA approved pension. And the current law is a little bit unclear that they are allowed to keep whichever amount is higher for their own personal needs. Section 22 is clarifying that the cost of a private room in an assisted living facility cannot be used as part of a medical spend down and codifying again current practice. Sections 23 and 24 are clarifying that MA coverage for inpatient hospital services are limited to those for which a hospital holds a Medicare certification, and that's per federal law. And the current state law is a little bit confusing on that, and so we're hoping to clean that up. And then finally, Section 29, this is really correcting a drafting error. We had the year 2016, I believe, in state law, and this actually took effect in 2017. And so we're correcting the historical record, if you will. And those are the provisions related from the DHS policy bill. I would also note, Madam Chair, that most of what I just went over was also heard by this committee last session. I'm sure that's not fresh in anyone's mind, but I just wanted to note that for the record.
Oh, Madam Chair, we can't hear you.
I'm sorry about that. So I just wanted to say thank you, Mr. Burdick first, and just to relate to everyone that House File 3727 is the vehicle bill from the omnibus bill that we are working on today. and 3727 is the healthcare policy bill, portion of the bigger bill. So we're going to move on to Article 2, looking at various section of House File 2635 of Representative Mann. This is a pharmacist bill, deals with pharmacists who are authorized to prescribe self-administered hormonal contraceptions, nicotine replacement medication, opiates, antagonists for treatment of acute opiate overdose. So we're going to have Representative Mann walk us through that and explain it to us in medical terms. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this bill aims to increase patient access to oral contraceptives, nicotine replacement drugs, and naloxone, which is an opioid antagonist. Basically, what that does is it treats acute opioid overdoses. We will do this by allowing pharmacists to prescribe these drugs. And these three drug classes were chosen secondary to their impacts on prevention and on public health. So we all know the tobacco statistics, but very briefly, tobacco kills 6,000 Minnesotans per year and causes over $3 billion in excess medical costs per year in Minnesota. We also know the opioid statistics. We've been digging deep into that this last year, but we are seeing increases in use and in death rates of opioid overdoses. And lastly, we all know that unintended pregnancies put and keep women in poverty. The estimated medical cost of unintended pregnancies are over $300 million per year in the state of Minnesota. And unintended pregnancies generally have poor outcomes for both moms and babies. The American College of Obstetricians, I can't say that word, and gynecologists have recommended that oral contraceptives be made available over the counter. This bill does not go as far as that. And lastly, we know that most Americans live within a 5-mile radius of a community pharmacy, so why not use this untapped resource to increase access to care? And that is the goal of this bill.
Thank you so much, Representative Mann. Members, do we have any questions? All right, seeing none, we'll move on to our last article, which is Article 2.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling has a question.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to break the quiet spell here that we've had. So I just have to ask Representative Mann. She knows I've had this same question, but I just want to hear it on the record here that there are some drugs that are for nicotine cessation that are not included here, right? I mean, this is just, could you just be a little more specific here on the record about what's not included? Because there are some that my understanding is really need a physician or a healthcare provider other than a pharmacist to determine if they're right for patients. So if you could be just a bit more specific, that'd be great.
Yeah, so the original version of the bill was tobacco cessation medications, which includes pills that can be used for other things and have significant side effects. So we did make sure to change that language to from tobacco cessation to nicotine replacement. So now we're strictly talking about patches and gums and lozenges, things of that nature, and not the medication used for tobacco cessation.
Representative Liebling, that's good. All right. Do we have any other questions? All right. And thank you, Representative Liebling, for that question. So we're going to move on to Article 2, House File 3402, is Representative Schultz, which deals with a physician assistant scope of practice changes. I do understand you have an author's amendment for this language. Would you like to move the A10 before you present, Representative Schultz?
If the timing is right, I would like to move the A10 amendment.
Perfect timing. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Please proceed, Representative Schultz.
Well, first I'll describe the underlying bill and then we can talk about what we just did, the amendment piece. So House File, this is based on House File 3402, and this is the bill that was introduced by myself and Representative Keel and Chair Moran and others. And it's intended to improve the ability of physician assistants or PAs to practice in Minnesota. It makes no changes in the scope of practice or education or training requirements of PAs for how PAs practice medicine. It does not allow for independent practice of PAs, and it maintains the role of a licensed physician in managing a PA's practice, but it really tries to accommodate our new integrated healthcare system, where when this language was developed, I don't know, 30 years ago, we had independent clinics and now we have integrated clinics. And it goes from having agreements with one physician with having agreements based at the practice level. So it's intended to reduce the paperwork hurdles and barriers that PAs have in getting hired and serving people in Minnesota, especially those in where we need, where the need is greatest in rural parts of the state in greater Minnesota. The bill has been passed through committees in the Senate. It has bipartisan support, and it has support from various stakeholders, like the Minnesota Hospital Association, and I know the Minnesota Medical Association was key in negotiating an agreement and compromise to move this bill forward, so I appreciate their support and their work. The amendment that we just adopted is to address any concerns that our stakeholders and advocates in the mental health community and NAMI Minnesota brought forward. So it provides more guardrails around cases where a child with an emotional disturbance or an adult with a serious mental illness is seen by a PA, and the PA is to make sure that that patient gets optimal care. So if they need a referral to a physician or a psychiatrist, that there's collaboration and consultation in that area. So I appreciate the work that was done over the weekend on drafting the amendment so people are comfortable with the overall bill. And I have, there is one testifier if we have time for testimony.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Members, do you have any questions?
Madam Chair, Representative Keel had a question.
Okay, Representative Keel.
You disappeared. thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schultz, I really appreciate this bill. I had some nice conversation with one of my PAs here, and he's been working here for 30 years, has quite a reputation, and is well respected in a small town. And he indicated to me that if we didn't change this, we would not be, hospitals, small hospitals would not even be looking at PAs. They just can't keep up with the requirements for the paperwork and the issues that involve having physical assistants, physician's assistants, excuse me, in our area. And it is, like Representative Schultz said, a necessary thing in rural Minnesota, because we need that those services. So anyway, thank you very much, and certainly support this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Are there any other further questions? Representative Schultz, do you think your testifier need to testify, or were they just there to respond to questions?
I think they're good, according to Chris. So they're right here to respond to questions, but if they desire to testify, I'll leave that up to Chair Moran.
All right, thank you. So we're going to move on then. We are done with the presentation by the...
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm sorry. My indication was that this would be the time to let the testifier address the committee.
The testifier?
Yep, we have her ready to go.
Okay, is it Leslie Neltier?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, okay, please present.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee. I don't want to belabor your process. I know you have a lot of work to do. I will say that as a PA in the state of Minnesota for almost 2 decades, this bill is key and essential for PAs being able to remain vital components in all areas of healthcare. I'm happy to answer any questions, but I don't want to belabor your process. Thank you for the opportunity to be present.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for being here and your testimony. Okay, members, we're going to move on. We have several amendments. Let me see. all the amendments. We have four amendments that you will, that will come before the body, and all four have been agreed upon between myself and Senator Benson as well. First one is the A3 amendment with Representative Bonner, and it deals with pharmacists authorized to administer COVID-19 vaccines, if we ever were to get one. Representative Bonner, can you explain your amendment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move the A3 amendment. This amendment essentially allows pharmacists to provide Minnesotans with COVID-19 or SARS, COVID-2 and related shots when the vaccine becomes available. Obviously, at this point, we do know that that is something that is currently in process. There are currently three companies that have started clinical trials, including one here in Minnesota, and we'll hear more that will be joining that soon. We know that experts like Dr. Fauci and others in the bank have been working on developing these around the world, and that there may be a vaccine or potentially something available by the end of Q4 of 2020, which is, of course, optimistic. But we already know that we may be able to have vaccinations done in Minnesota when the FDA gives their approval that we have a vaccine that is both safe and effective. The purpose of this amendment, of course, would then give shot parity with our law on flu shots and vaccines. But again, I want to stress that vaccines must be approved by the FDA for safety and efficacy. When pharmacists were given the authority to administer patient flu shots here in Minnesota, the state law saw that a 40% increase in patients that were able to get their annual flu vaccinations. Many folks see their pharmacist, in some cases even more often than their physician. Pharmacists and pharmacies were a great point of access for folks to get vaccinated. And I also want to make one additional point, and then I will go ahead and turn this back to the chair. This amendment does not force anyone to get a vaccination. That remains a decision between a patient and their doctor, and we certainly understand and know that there are some folks that for various reasons where vaccination may not be a good idea, particularly those who may be immunocompromised. But certainly for those where it is an option, particularly in high-risk populations, this is an option to make sure that we can get those vaccines out there more quickly when they become available. And with that, I will turn it back over and renew my motion to move the A3 amendment, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Members, are there any questions?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright has a question.
To Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, not so much a question, but I would like to speak in favor of the A3 amendment. As Representative Bonner has already intimated, it's going to be very, very important for our frontline medical service personnel, particularly the pharmacists, to be able to disseminate and provide a vaccine or any type of medications that might be coming out of our biopharma community going forward. I think it's vitally important that they have the availability to provide those to those people that would want those in a timely basis. And so I would urge the membership of this community to support this amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Are there any other questions? We're seeing none. All in favor of the A3 amendment, say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Thank you, Representative Bonner. We're going to move on to the A4 amendment. Representative Morrison, pharmacists who are authorized to interchange drugs during COVID emergency. Representative Morrison, can you explain your amendment?
Madam Chair, yes, I'd like to move the A4 amendment. This amendment provides some flexibility for pharmacists to make sure that patients are able to access the medications they need during the peacetime emergency. We rely on pharmacists in Minnesota for advice and access to medications we need to stay healthy and alive, whether we're facing a pandemic or not. Minnesota's roughly 2,100 pharmacists are working to adapt to this outbreak, which means more time on the phone with patients and expanding drive-through capacity and delivery services to reduce close contact interactions. Whether it's in a community pharmacy setting, a health system, or a clinic setting, pharmacists need the flexibility to make sure patients in Minnesota receive the therapies their providers have prescribed for them. Patients and our pharmacists in Minnesota are concerned about the coronavirus. These worries are exacerbated by anxiety about disruption to the global drug supply chain and shortages of their medications. A patient with type 1 diabetes can live only a few days without insulin. The same fear is felt by Minnesotans who rely on blood thinners to prevent strokes, ACE inhibitors to lower blood pressure, seizure medications, statins for their cholesterol, and numerous other medications that may be in short or no supply. As you've heard before, many drugs are made outside of the United States, and most medication ingredients are sourced outside the U.S. Currently, there are 111 drugs either in low supply or out of stock as of yesterday, and we fear that shortages will only increase. So the A4 amendment, therapeutic drug interchange during Minnesota's peacetime emergency, will provide pharmacists with the authority and flexibility to change a patient's medication within the same AHFS therapeutic drug category should the medication prescribed not be available due to a shortage and a pharmacist not being able to reach the prescribing provider to seek a different prescription medication for their ailment or therapy. So the language limits the pharmacist's use to the medication can only be interchanged when a pharmacy could not obtain a drug from the manufacturer, a wholesaler, or other pharmacy. The pharmacist is unable to reach the patient's prescriber in a reasonable amount of time. The drug interchange must be made within the same AHFS drug therapy category. And this expires 60 days after the governor rescinds the peacetime emergency. So that is the gist of the A4 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Members, are there any questions? Jasmine, do we have any questions?
Madam Chair, I'm not seeing any questions.
All right, thank you. We're seeing none. All in favor of the A4?
Oh, Madam Chair, I apologize. Representative Liebling just raised her hand.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to ask a lot of questions of our physician legislators today, I guess. Representative Morrison, thank you for this. Is this, I think it sounds like a great idea, but I'm just worrying a little bit or wanted to find out about coverage for the drug. So this, I assume that this amendment, which I haven't, I've been trying to read it here on the screen, but is this going to be covered by the patient's insurance or what's the status of that if there should need to be a substitution?
Representative Morrison.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I may need to phone a friend on that. I would assume so, but I do not know the answer to that.
This is Sarah Dare with the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. I was on if there is testimony needed for something else, but I'm happy to answer this question. Pharmacists are going to do everything in their power and everything that's reasonable to make sure that whatever medication we switch over to is covered and that it is safe and effective for the patient as well. So we will definitely look into coverage, and if it's one class, such as a cholesterol medication, and one isn't available, we will look at all the others that they could potentially use, and if it's equivalent and if it's something that is actually covered by their insurance, we would focus mostly on making sure the patient doesn't have to pay extra.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I think that's great, and I'm sure pharmacists will do their best, but in some other situations, we've actually legislatively required that the payers pay for it. And this would seem to be a situation where that would be reasonable, even if it's not, you know, sometimes they'll have one drug and not another on their formulary. So it could be a vast difference for the patient if they don't agree to just allow the substitution or if we don't require them to. So I just wanted to raise that. I don't know that we can do anything about it now, but something we should be thinking about, I think. And I know Representative Morrison thinks a lot about these issues. So I will just, having just raised the issue, I'll just leave it in her hands to deal with that. But it probably would have been a good one to go right along with this amendment.
That's a very, very good catch, Chair Liebling. And of course, we have seen that type of issue of concern come before the body before. So, yeah, we will hopefully, Representative Morrison will continue to work on that and just maybe do some check-in to see that data is in coverage if prescriptions need to be interchanged. Members, do we have any other questions? Okay, with that, all in favor of the A4 amendment, say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We're going to move on to the A5 amendment, which is Representative Keel amendment, and it deals with the television supervision for physician therapy assistance during COVID-19 emergency. Representative Keel, would you like to move your amendment and then explain it?
Madam Chair, yes, I would. So this is, think about the physical therapist assistants that work with, along with our physical therapists. And many of them do things like go into nursing homes and work with people. But this is a, would end 60 days after a peacetime emergency, but allow them to not have quite as much oversight as they work. So there's not that in and out, more of a distance type of observation so that the treatment can continue for those who need physical therapy.
Representative Keating, just for, I don't know, and maybe you did you move the A5 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, maybe I didn't say it, but can we please move the A5 amendment?
All right, thank you. Members, do you have any questions on the A5 amendment? All right, seeing none, all in favor of the A5 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Okay, we're going to move on to the A8 amendment, which is my amendment. And it deals with the last service line replacement authority modification. So I would like to first move the A8 amendment. Members, this is language of House File 3486, which was Representative Jordan's bill, allowing the use of dollars from the Drinking Water Revolving Loan Fund to replace privately owned portions of lead drinking water service lines in addition to the public portion in our community. This was a Department of Health proposal that we heard in committee on March the 3rd, but it was not introduced in the Senate. So Chair Benson has agreed to its inclusion as part of our agreement in exchange for adopting the next amendment that I will offer. Are there any questions to the A8 amendment? Okay, seeing none, all in favor for the A8 amendment, say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. I'm going to move on to the A9 amendment, which is also my amendment, and it's dealing with the midwifery scope of practice. So finally, I will move the A9 amendments. Remember, this language comes from the Senate File 4217, which was a bill authored by Senator Matthews in the other body that was not introduced in the House prior to the COVID-19 crisis. The bill expands and clarifies the legal scope of practice for licensed midwives by authorizing them to order ultrasounds and standard prenatal laboratory tests, as well as provide point-of-care testing like a fingerprint blood test and a urinary test. Some licensed midwives in the state already have agreement with the birth centers to order ultrasounds, which is covered by insurance. However, access to imaging is not uniform across the state and is especially less common in rural areas. A radiologist is still responsible for interpreting their results, but this language ensures that midwives can order the routine ultrasounds they use to help expecting mothers determine their due date and perform a 20-week fetal survey. They are still expected to transfer care to a physician if any testing or image results suggest an abnormal pregnancy, as outlined in a written plan they are already required to create with the mother. This bill was heard in the Senate on March the 12th. I know it has bipartisan support. My senator personally texted me last week to ask me about the bill, which was great because I know we had not heard it in the House. So Senator Pappas, along with many other Democrats, are supporting this language in the Senate. So what the language in the A9 amendment was agreed to as a compromise between the City Council of Certified Professional Midwives and the Minnesota chapter of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, or the ACOG. Any testing or image orders authorized through this bill must conform to the licensed traditional midwife standard of care, and licensed midwives remain subject to review and by the Board of Medical Practice. So with that, are there any questions about the A9 amendments?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling has a question.
Yes, Representative Liebling.
Don't everybody jump in here. Madam Chair, thank you. I actually have several questions about this. First of all, I just want to clarify, I know that some licensed midwives are also advanced practice nurses. This is not who we're talking about, right? Those APRNs who do midwifery are already, I assume, able to order these kinds of tests. Is that correct?
So I need a lifeline here. I know we did speak to Representative Morrison before we thought about, you know, accepting this amendment or negotiating. So I would like this someone from the department who can respond to this, and or Representative Morrison who can respond to questions, that would be great.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Sunderman has also offered to provide some explanation.
Okay, Ms. Sunderman.
Madam Chair, members, yes, this only applies to the licensed traditional midwives, not the APRNs who would already be able to perform these sorts of tests and order ultrasounds.
So, Madam Chair, if I could continue here. So this is, from what I'm understanding here, it would be allowing some tests to be ordered that under current law would not be ordered. So my next question is whether there would be a cost for this provision, because there might be more, or is this replacing tests that would have been ordered in other settings? When you add things to Medicaid and make them billable, which is what I assume this is doing, there would usually be a cost associated with that. I don't know if Ms. Sunderman can give me assistance on that, or if it need to be somebody from DHS.
So the bill does expand and clarifies the legal scope of practice for the licensed midwives by authorizing them to order ultrasounds and standard prenatal laboratory tests. Ms. Sutherland, can you add 2 minutes?
Madam Chair and members, I don't think I can speak directly to the cost, but I think most of these tests and ultrasounds would already happen. It's just a matter of the licensed traditional midwife being able to order them. I don't know if Matt Burdick is still on and could speak to any costs this might have
Mr. Burdick?
The department, but.
Certainly, Madam Chair. To the question, we do not assess a cost on this. Typically, when we're talking about changes in scope of practice, especially when it's for services that we already cover, we're just changing who could provide that service. We just assume that service would otherwise have been delivered by a different practitioner, unless there is a demonstrated access issue that we could put a cost on. But typically, we don't have a means of assessing what a cost for these types of changes would be.
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you. And also I just got an email from Mr. Berg telling me that there's no cost on this. The other thing that I would have concern about, or at least a question about, it's one thing to order a test, and it's another thing to interpret the test. And that's why I started out with a question about APRNs who are, you know, have advanced training in a more medicalized, I guess, for lack of a better word, sphere. And so even though I, it's one thing to order the test, does this mean that the traditional midwives would also be interpreting the test? And if there's, I get it that we're expanding who can order a test that's already authorized, but as part of this, are we also expanding authorization for the traditional midwife to interpret the tests that are being ordered, or is that being done by a physician who's working with that person, or an advanced practice nurse who's working with that person?
Yeah. So, Chair Liebling, I agree. You know, these are some of the same thought or questions that I had when I looked at expanding the scope of midwives and what they could do in that process. I would like if Mr. Burdick is still on the line here, if you can respond to that question. It is expanding the scope, but it's also asking them to interpret the imagery that they see. I would guess that maybe in the rural communities is, done a little bit more than in the urban core where you have readable access to a physician. But can you answer that question?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know that we're necessarily the experts on kind of the scope issues, but I will say, in our assessment of this bill, since it didn't create a new covered service for Medicaid, we didn't we don't really see any direct interactions other than there might be some new people offering some of these services.
Representative Chair Liebling.
Well, Madam Chair, I do have a problem with this. I'm not comfortable with it. It sounds pretty innocuous on the surface, but the problem is, and this is always a tough balance that we have when we're talking about shortages of healthcare personnel. Is it okay to say, because you're rural and you have a shortage, that it's okay to have somebody who doesn't have the same level of training, who may not give you the same level of service, and so on? And, I think that I have great respect for traditional midwives, but I'm not sure they're qualified, and without any testimony about it, or I am a little bit comforted that the ACOG signed off on this apparently. I'd love it if there was somebody here to talk about that, why they think it's okay. But I guess, well, I mean, is there anybody on the call who can even speak to what would be the setting in which they'd be doing this? Are we talking about, I guess you got to have an ultrasound machine, so I guess you're going to be in a rural hospital, or can you have an office where you have your own ultrasound machine, or, you know, exactly how is this all going to take place? Because it does, I am concerned about expanding that scope of practice without considerable amount of testimony about it and, you know, more examination. Having this come in as an amendment from the Senate where they say, oh, they've heard the bill, you know, makes me nervous because this is, you know, serious things can happen to women who are pregnant and to their fetuses. And this may be fine, but I'm not really comfortable with this as it is before us today.
So Representative Morrison, do you think that maybe you could speak to this, to our Chair Liebling questions in regards to the experience or the expertise that a midwife brings to the delivery or oversight of a woman who is pregnant?
Madam Chair and Chair Liebling, I very much appreciate your comment that pregnancy is serious business because it is. And I shared a lot of your concerns about this. I hadn't seen it until 2 days ago. But I spoke with ACOG and some of the people from ACOG, which is the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, is kind of the governing body for OBGYNs in our country. And they work through this with the midwives, and the arrangement is for those ultrasounds will be ordered through radiologists or for other qualified obstetricians who perform ultrasound and will be interpreted by them. And they will have the proper ultrasound credentialing and training to do so. There, I believe in statute are indications for when transfer of care is appropriate. And midwives are by and large wonderful in that respect. You know, there are midwives who are not great and there are obstetricians who are not great, but for the most part, midwives practice, take wonderful care of their patients and transfer care appropriately when it becomes a high risk pregnancy. So ACOG was comfortable with this language and they allayed a lot of my concerns. But you're asking the right question. If you order a test, you got to know what to do with the result and who is coming up with the result. Thanks for bringing those questions up. I hope that allays some of your fears.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Morrison. That is really helpful. But what I do wonder, though, is, I mean, that arrangement does allay my fears, but it's not in the bill. It's not in the law. So when we're giving this additional scope of practice to these practitioners, we're basically saying, you know, you could do it. I don't know if maybe Ms. Sunderman can help me out here, whether in order for them to be interpreting the test, whether that would be something additional. If this language doesn't give them the authority to be the interpreter of these tasks so that it has to be interpreted by another professional as you've described, that would be fine. But I'm just concerned about what we're doing here with the language, that it doesn't reflect that kind of agreement. And this is a permanent change, as I understand. This is not one of those COVID-19 during the emergency, we need to do something additional kind of amendments. Ms. Sunderman, can you help me out?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, if you, Chapter 147D is the greater chapter dealing with traditional midwifery licensure and practice. Sorry, my internet's very slow. My husband is also in a Zoom meeting right now. So Chapter 147D, Section 147D.05, relates to the professional conduct, and that that outlines when a a licensed traditional midwife would transfer care to a physician or an APRN. And then this language specifically, it does not specifically say they are allowed to interpret testing. They can order the ultrasounds, provide point of care testing, and order lab tests. It does not say they can interpret the lab tests. If it would be sort of outside the traditional midwife's standard of care and their written protocol that they're required to enter into for each patient under Chapter 147D. So I'm not sure if that answers your question. I think that the Board of Medical Practice, who licenses the traditional midwives, may be able to better answer your specific question if you'd like to contact them, or I can contact them via email.
So Chair Liebling, so I'm going to, and maybe I didn't explain it clear enough, but did bills authorize a midwife to order an ultrasound and a standard prenatal laboratory test? But a radiologist is still responsible for interpreting the results, right? And so what this language ensures that the midwife can order the routine ultrasound they use to help expecting mothers determine the due date and perform a 20-week fetal survey. So, and the midwives are still expected to transfer the care to the physician if any testing or image results suggest an abnormal pregnancy. So it is the radiologist who is going to interpret, right? They do the interpretation, but it just allows a midwife to do the ordering of it. So that's the expansion of the scope that's happening within this bill, is the ordering of the testing.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, thank you for putting that on the record. I was just going to say that with that on the record, I think we could move on with it, but I just think that's very, very important what you just clarified and what Representative Morrison clarified, because I just don't, you know, I just want to make sure that because, you know, we have shortages, that we don't expand people's scope beyond where they really should be going given the training that they have. So thank you very much for that.
Madam Chair,
Representative Keel, Representative Freiberg, and Representative Mann all have questions.
Okay, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I'm gonna speak as a grandmother. My girls have, I have 10 grandchildren. I actually have 17 and two more on the way. But 10 of them have been delivered by midwives. And the last set of grandchildren, two of them had IUGR, which is one is a set of twins. And I happen to know what happened there in both cases. One, they did not do an ultrasound. Baby was born. That's when they discovered it was IUGR. I do think that the midwife would have done something had she expected it. Very seasoned RN, so she wasn't without her knowledge. But the second set were twins, and when they discovered there were twins, they were and they had IUGR. It was recommended right away that they go to an obstetrician, and the babies were delivered at Children's or at the Mother Baby Center in the cities, actually. And my experience, I have to admit, I was very hesitant when my girls told me that they were going to be doing this. However, I've actually been at one of the deliveries and feel much more relaxed about what happens. And I know that OBGYNs are always referred to once they do the ultrasound, but in one case, she didn't have the ability to send my daughter to an ultrasound without going. She would have had to gone to a doctor, and I mean, it just was too, I think it was discouraging to go and get an ultrasound rather than make it better and be able to discover something earlier, and of course send mother and baby to an OBGYN, who would have more knowledge. So I actually think this is a better way to go than to not have this ability. And in all of the cases I've seen, they immediately, midwives do immediately call in other people then and direct mothers in a different direction because of their need for services. So I'm more relaxed about this than I would be if we didn't do this. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Freiberg?
You covered it when you explained the difference between ordering a test and interpreting the results, Madam Chair, so I'll pass.
Okay. Representative Mann?
Pass.
All right. Thank you. Chair Liebling, we feel a little bit more comfortable with knowing that it is the radiologist who is responsible for interpreting. We're just giving them the ability to order. So with that, and seeing no further discussion, the chair renews her motion to adopt the A9 amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So the final motions, there are no further amendments, and the chair renews her motion to adopt the DE1 amendment as amended. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the DE1 amendment as amended is adopted. So is there any further discussion on House File 3727 before we vote on passage of the bill?
Madam Chair?
Chris?
I just wanted to remind you to make a quick note about the podiatrist provision.
Yes, yes. Let me look to my notes here. Give me a moment here. Thank you for that reminder, Chris. Okay. Before we move this bill, I did, thank you. I wanted to let members know that there will likely be a floor amendment to this bill that was agreed to by Senator Benson and myself earlier today. I received notice after the filing deadline for today's hearing about a unique issue facing podiatrists in Minnesota due to the COVID-19 crisis. The Board of Podiatry is unique in that it has an 8-hour limit for online continuing education credits written into state statute. Since in-person training events are being canceled for the foreseeable future, the statutory requirement will make it difficult for some practitioner to reach the 40-hour of continued education required for their renewing their license every 2 years. So Senator Benson and I have agreed to a final amendment for this bill that will allow all online education credit earned 60 days after the peacetime emergency to count towards the 40-hour requirement. Committee staff will share the language with members for review once it is drafted. But I expect to see this language on the House floor tomorrow. And it has been agreed upon between Vincent and myself. It's a unique circumstances right now with all in-person, with all of the cancellations that's happening right now. So do any members have any questions in regards to this amendment that will come to the floor tomorrow? Well, not really tomorrow, but it will come to the floor amendment when this bill reaches the floor. Okay, thank you. So with that, there being no further discussion, the chair removes her motion that House File 3727 as amended be recommended for placement on the general register and that the House research staff be directed to make technical and conforming changes as necessary, stated with the podiatry amendment that's coming forth. So we will do a roll call for this vote. So everyone should unmute themselves at this time, and Jazzy would take the roll.
Representative Moran?
Aye.
Representative Morrison?
Aye.
Representative Keel?
Aye.
Representative Albright?
Aye.
Representative Backer?
Aye.
Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Representative Edelson?
Yes.
Representative Fisher?
Aye.
Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Mann?
Aye.
Representative New? Excused. Representative Pearson?
Aye.
Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, aye.
Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Madam Chair, there are 17 ayes, 0 nays, and 1 excused.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Jazzy. So there have been 17 ayes and 0 nays. The motion prevails. House File 3727 as amended is recommended for placement on the general register. In-house research staff are instructed to make technical and conforming changes as necessary. Well, members, this is most likely our last meeting, our last hearing. We have spent a lot of time together over the last 2 years to pass new policy that will help the people of Minnesota. The two bills we have passed out of committee in the last week represent an incredible body of work given the unique challenges we have faced this year. I know we all have several competing demands on our time in these final weeks, but I want to give members a chance to share your any thoughts or reflection that you may have, that you have worked on, that you have done in this biennium that you would like to lift up. And I will hold my remarks to the end, but is there anyone else who would like to say something as we end our last day of hearing? I'm happy to give you the floor. Representative Keel.
Here we are, and under challenging circumstances, but certainly thank you to our staff, both of our staffs, the nonpartisan, and all the work that has been put into this biennium. So just want to thank you, Chair Moran, for your work, and thank you.
Okay. Is there anyone else who would like to do some parting, kind of like parting words? All right. Chair Liebling?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to add my thanks, too. This has been a really challenging couple of years. I mean, not just the COVID-19, but this committee's done a lot of work, has heard a lot of bills. And I really want to thank you, Madam Chair, for your hard work. And also Chris McCall in particular has done an enormous amount of work to get all of this through. And all of our House research staff, our partisan research staff as well, both DFL and Republican staff. And it just takes an enormous amount of work to make all of these things happen. And it's been a really great effort, and getting these two large bills out is a significant amount of work. So I just want to add my thanks and appreciation for everybody for all the hard work that everybody's done this last couple of years.
Thank you, Chair Leedon. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Chair Moran. I particularly want to thank you, Madam Chair, for leading all of us so ably and for being a mentor to me. It was just a real pleasure to serve under you these 2 years. And Chris McCall has been fabulous. Jazzy, you're great. Everyone has been wonderful. And I appreciate the great dialogue that we've had between Democrats and Republicans. I've learned from all of you, and I'm grateful for this experience. So thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Morrison. So I would just like to share that this has been an incredible 2 years for me, learning how to be a chair, learning how to serve a policy committee, my committee, you know, really creating and allowing a space for people's voices to be heard was really important to me on both sides of the aisle. I think my patience grew even more challenging a huge committee like this, where we passed an incredible amount of bills. We definitely heard an incredible amount of bills in Health and Human Service. So, and learning how to, you know, when time permitted, to be able to do this work through a bipartisan lens. So it has been really a great learning experience for me. I have been really at all by many of our freshman legislators and all of my legislators on both sides of the aisle. It's been a really incredible journey. And so I just want to thank you all for your willingness to spend so much time with this committee, with the extra hearings, the late night, you know, kudos and thank you to my vice chair for Vice Chair Morrison for taking over. And you guys don't know, you know, when I was out because I had caught the flu, you know, she stepped right in. And the moments I had, I just want to say thank you to my vice chair. It's been incredible. I also want to say thanks, members, for maintaining a respectful and cooperative atmosphere as we deliberated legislation in a policy era that can sometimes be very contentious, right? Because sometimes we just see the world differently. But I believe in a big way was able to be really respectful and cooperative overall. Legislation on policy areas that are particularly proud of committee who have worked on, you know, looking at the work that we did around the mental health, the children and family services, health equity, all of those have, I mean, it's just too much to try to think about all that we have done in this committee. I want to thank the minority leader, Keel, for your leadership in leading the committee, both, you know, at the table and really behind scenes where we had to make those phone calls and talk things through. Just want to say thank you for your willingness to be available and in communication. I want to thank the nonpartisan staff for all of your hard work, especially during the current crisis where we have had limited resources, limited time. You've been inundated. You have stood strong and just, I don't know how you guys do it, but thank goodness for research and nonpartisan partisan staff. We could not do this work without you. Thank you so much. I want to thank Mr. Chung and Ms. Sunderman and Ms. Marquess and Ms. Pinelli and Mr. Berg, all the support staff in House Research and in the Revisor Office. Thank you, partisan staff, nonpartisan staff. I want to thank our caucus researcher, Joe, Doris Durham, and Jeremiah. I want to thank you so much for both of your work in this committee. I want to thank my former CLA, Alyssa Frist. I also want to thank my current CLA, Jazzy, Ms. Jazzy. I want to thank you so much. You jumped in and I have worked with you. So I just want to say thank you for just being so patient and just doing an awesome job. And last but not least, as a new chair of one of the biggest committees in the House of Representatives, I could have not done this work without Chris McCall. Chris came from the Senate. He is just absolutely fantastic. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your leadership, for your hard work, for your commitment to the people in the state of Minnesota. I would like to encourage members to continue working with and listening to patients, providers, constituents in the months ahead, and to contact me if you see additional opportunities to help address the current health crisis through legislation. There's so much work to look at moving forward. COVID-19 is so real. It is impacting so many people's lives in the workforce, housing, schools. It can just go on and on and on. You know, when we talk about healthcare, we are in a moment of time right now. And so let's continue to do the work of the people. And with that, I am done. And so there been no other business before the committee. We are adjourned.